It's another Sunday afternoon, time for Wordplay here on WPVM 103.5. And that, yes, your ears are not deceiving you, that's Van Halen playing their great mega hit Jump. Probably the first time it's ever been broadcast here at WPVM. Anyway, today we're talking with Columbia novelist Jana McMahon, mostly about her novel Calling Home. Here's Jana. Jana, thanks so much for coming on to Wordplay.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, you've got one novel out, and
yes,
one on the way, coming up in April.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Ocean Inside will be out in April.
Uh-huh. And how long has your first novel been out? Is it?
It came out in February,
out in
2008.
February. 2008. Yes. Mm-hmm. You must write fast.
The last one I wrote really fast. The first one, Calling Home. It took me a couple of years, and then you have to go through the process of finding the agent and finding the publisher, and so you have the opportunity to polish a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a two-book deal with Kensington, so I had to crank the second one out.
Uh-huh.
I already had the idea in the first couple of chapters working for a couple of years, but ended up having to really crank for 6 months. So
mm-hmm.
Now I'm getting faster. Hopefully I'm getting better. I know a lot of people put a book out every single year. I'm not sure that I'm up to that.
Gads.
Seriously. People like Jodi Picoult, they put a book out every year. Uh-huh. But, I write relatively fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Great. I wish I did. Yeah. That's really remarkable. So, how long did it take you to write Calling Home?
It takes me about a year to write
yeah.
a novel, and then about a year to be happy with it.
Yeah.
Because it's a constant source of discovery, and so you see something, oh, I know where I can use that. I'll take it and put it in that chapter, or I will use that to describe this person, or, oh, that's a great name. I think I'll change the name of that character.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've done things like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How do you write? What's your process? Do you sit down at a computer keyboard, or do you work in longhand? Or
No, everything's done on the computer.
Everything's done on the computer.
It's yeah. really kind of sad now that everything is done on the computer because, quite frankly, you lose a lot of early ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I make sure that I keep copies from the beginning all the way through to the final product.
Yeah.
You have all of these wonderful writers like, Hemingway, who their papers are the basis of great collections at universities.
Right.
But we're going to have less and less of that now because writers are deleting ideas that they don't use instead of keeping them on file. So
right.
I try, even if I have a good idea that I don't use in a book, I try to file it away somewhere where I can find it again and perhaps use it in the future for a different story.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. A good idea. And you're right. Computers make that more difficult because you overwrite your previous file if you save under the same file name under any operating system. So,
true.
Yeah, you have to be especially mindful if you want to save a previous version, you save under a different name, save your new file under a different name. And yeah.
True. Ideas are my currency, though.
Yeah.
So I need to make sure that I keep up with every idea I have, and I have notebooks that I write in, scattered in my car, all over my house, in my office,
mm-hmm.
and every so often I will gather them up and put them in an idea file. I have an idea file of newspaper clippings and magazine clippings and, anything I see that interests me. I keep everything. I guess you would call me an idea pack rat
uh-huh.
to a certain extent. I'm actually a very neat person.
Uh-huh.
I have very neat files and I can put my hand on anything. But I do have a tremendous amount of just raw information
yeah.
that I can draw from.
Yeah. Hmm. So you must have been collecting information for a long time, I would think. I mean, how far back have you been collecting information? Usually pack ratism starts when you're quite young.
Well, I always had these this ability to discern what I thought was something odd or strange, and I would always write it down. Like when I was in high school, we had a male and female physical teacher, you know, PE teachers, who were married to each other, and their last name was Waddle. And I always thought it was so funny that the PE teacher's last names were Waddle. And no one ever said to me, well, you know, yes, we think that's funny too. So I just sort of never expressed that opinion. And I see odd things like that. Like when I was in college, there's this giant sign at the University of Kentucky. And you go in one side of the sign and you come out the other side of the sign. So there's this giant sign that says University of Kentucky. And down on the bottom left, it says, do not enter. And I see things like that all the time. Like right on the road on the highway on 40 between Asheville and Knoxville, there's this giant billboard that says, homemade fudge factory outlet. I just find hysterical. And,
that's kind of a hoot. Yeah, kind of a hoot. So homemade fudge factory outlet. Yeah.
So I collect all of these odd little things, and then someone will say something, or I'll see something, I'll say, that'll make a great name for a short story. So that goes in my short story file, and and I might see a dress someone has on, and I think, that's perfect for a character. And I'll describe the dress and then just stick that paragraph in my idea file, and I have it forever.
Waiting to emerge in a future book.
Yes.
That's great. When did you start writing?
Apparently before I remember, because my mother, I'm from a very small town in Kentucky.
Grew up
in Kentucky, and the town I'm from is called Campbellsville. And I went to school with a girl named Lisa, graduated with her, and she became a nurse. And my mother called me one day and said, do you remember Lisa? And I was like, yeah, I remember her. And she said, well, Lisa asked me if you ever made a writer. And I asked her why she wanted to know, and she said, because I still have a lot of her stories that she wrote in the fifth grade and was going to throw away one day, and I kept them because I thought, oh no, she'll be a writer someday.
Wow.
In the fifth grade. I'm sure there was something, you know, very, very boring, like The Haunted House or something like that, but because I was really into, you know,
the ghost stories
and things like that, and then, you know, graduated to Stephen King, and then I started reading adult literature when I was 11. Our hometown didn't have a library until then, and when I was 11 and the library opened, I said, Mom, I want to volunteer at the library. She let me do whatever I wanted to do, so I went in the first day and asked the librarian, what's the most famous book in the world? And she said, why, honey, that would be the Bible.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I've read that enough.
Yeah. What's the second most famous book?
And she said, well, I guess that would probably be Gone with the Wind. Mm-hmm. And what a great book to start with.
Oh, yeah.
It has so many elements that that people strive to master today.
Yeah.
But I probably read that book like four or five times before I graduated from high school. It's just so well put together and has so many elements to it that I really admire.
Yeah, fabulous book. I mean, for those.
I mean, it really is, and so many Southern writers.
Not in vogue, I guess, at the moment. But you know.
Well, that's true, but you know, who cares? A lot of Southern writers will say that they were influenced by that book, but I don't think it's. It's a bad thing to say because it's such a terrific book.
And,
you know, growing up in the country and not having access, we had one radio station. We could get two television stations from Louisville and, you know, KET, Kentucky Educational Television. Mm-hmm. And so the opening of the library was like the opening of the world to me.
Right.
It was a major deal. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there I discovered Kurt Vonnegut and John Irving. Of course, I read, you know, the Bronte sisters and Jane Austen. And I was just a voracious reader. My mother said that she could never punish me by sending me to my room because that's where I preferred
to be. That's where you
read. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So that was your treat.
So that was fun. Yeah. I just love to sit on the bed and read.
What did your folks do? What was
my father's a United Parcel Service package delivery driver, and my mother was a homemaker, and she sewed underwear in an underwear factory in a union underwear, and we called it Fruit of the Loom Factory. That has since moved to Central America.
Yeah.
Thank you, NAFTA. And my hometown unemployment rate is way over 20%.
Wow.
Now because of that.
It's depression level. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Truly.
Right. So do you still have family there?
My entire family.
Entire family.
As a matter of fact, I just drove back from there.
Right.
My daughter has a week with her grandparents every summer.
Mm-hmm.
And we still own a farm, and we have a creek that runs through it. And that is her favorite place in the world, go chase the crawdads and the minnows and, hang out and listen to the frogs croak and it's kind of a zen thing. I mean, we live in Columbia, South Carolina, and it's not a huge city, but we do live in town, in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a reprieve to be able to be in the country. And
sure.
And I love Asheville, and I've always thought about moving to Asheville because, you could have an intellectual, stimulating place to live with good restaurants, but you could also be in the middle of the woods in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I like that. I love going to New York, go frequently, but could never, ever live there.
Right.
Because I need a little bit more peace than that.
Great place to visit, as we say.
It is, truly.
Well, why don't you share a little bit of calling home with us?
Okay.
So this is basically a kind of novel about the education of the heroine, in some sense, a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story.
Well,
but it's multi-generational.
It is multi-generational, and when I was trying to find an agent, I got a lot of very positive comments about my writing. Oh, your writing's beautiful. Mm-hmm. The story is lovely. We think this is great. But they kept coming back to, but we really can't sell coming of age stories right now. Mm-hmm. I just don't know where I'm going to sell that, or I have too many people who write coming of age stories. And so I took that as a suggestion that I perhaps should reorient the book a little bit and make it more about the mother in the book. And all I did to do that was write a different first chapter and put it in front of what was my opening chapter that opened with the teenage daughter's point of view. I just wrote another chapter and different intro from the mother's point of view, and it sold immediately.
Wow.
So that's a little market information there. I don't think most people think about
but it
that.
It does. But it reorients the book totally. Having read it now, I can go back and take, if I delete that first chapter, I've got a very different book.
Yeah, yes, yeah. I believe so too.
Yeah.
And I think it was a good suggestion, and I needed to listen to what these people were saying. I mean, this is my debut novel, and you have to be flexible. That doesn't mean you have to take everyone's suggestions. That is a fine line that you walk as an author.
Right.
I hear criticism from my writing group or from my MFA program or from, whomever I ask to read my book, agents, editors. What do I wish to take and think is valid, and what do I want to stand my ground on and say, this is important to the story and I'm not changing it.
Yeah,
but as soon as I realized that, I knew just exactly what the chapter would be. I mean, I wrote it in like one day.
Uh-huh.
I knew exactly what the chapter needed to be. So it was a good thing.
Great, great.
Thank you.
you think you could tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell?
You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 Asheville. Today we're talking with Columbia novelist Jana McMahon. Here's Jana.
Why don't you read that one for us?
Okay, so here's the new first chapter. The window gave a couple of inches. Virginia, poised on a cinder block, put her hand against the bottom of the sash and shoved again. Paint fractured and fluttered down as the frame broke loose and slid up. The reek of nicotine tinged with perfume seeped over her, a sour contrast to the clean air outside. It was a vivid day. The sky seemed close as Kentucky skies can, as if you could just reach out and touch the pale smear of clouds. Virginia squinted into the dark interior. She could see it was a bedroom, as she had anticipated. Not hard to figure out where things were in these rectangular brick boxes. People had started trading tall, breezy farmhouses for the central air of squat ranches with hardly enough room to make up a bed, and no kitchen big enough to have a family meal. She hoisted herself up onto the ledge, her pants snagged on rough brick and ripped. She stopped, balanced on her stomach, half in, half out of the window, to inspect the dirty, thin streaks of blood where her forearms had scraped the window ledge. She hadn't expected to have to go to so much trouble. Most people around Falling Rock never locked their doors. But this woman was from Louisville. She had paranoid city habits. Virginia dropped down onto the floor, her heart beating in her ears as if she were underwater. She felt submerged. Her movements measured, her legs heavy. What was she looking for? What did she hope to find, to not find, in this woman's house? The louvered closet door screeched as she pushed it aside, and there she saw what she came for. His frayed jeans with the torn pocket, scarred hunting boots. Proof. A metal tang came to her mouth, an angry taste she recognized. Her fingers itched to rake everything in the room into a shattered pile. She imagined the perfume bottles on the woman's vanity, the hand mirror and brushes and combs in a grotesque dance on the hardwood, the cut glass lamps and crystal ashtrays, one with Roger's cigarette stubs, the others with her long, skinny ones all crinkled down. She could sweep from the bedside tables with one swipe. She could find scissors and cut blouses and skinny little jeans to shreds. Bleach would ruin every carpet and drape and bed linen in the house. She felt a stinging on her leg and turned in the vanity mirror to check where she had caught her pants. A right angle was neatly cut from the thin material, and her skin underneath was abraded. She saw herself fully then, ruddy cheeks and dark hair and riotous curls around her shoulders. She didn't like what she saw, this woman with a set jaw and hollow eyes. She jerked suddenly, her attention focused down the narrow hall. Was that a car door thudding shut? Virginia reactively laid her hand to her heart. Its staccato throb under her fingertips threatened to burst through her bones. She crept to the kitchen, where she scanned through the kitchen shears. Nothing in the carport. She peeked through dust-filmed windows in the front room. No truck on the gravel road beyond. She moved from window to window, checking every possible angle before she was satisfied that nobody had arrived. It was her imagination. She checked to be sure that they were in town before she came. And she gave a little laugh then. Silly, she whispered. Why was she so jumpy? She'd thought this through. She knew what she was doing. Her car was hidden on the other side of the woods behind the house. There was a farm road that cut through fields to the next road over. She'd have to open and close a few cattle gates, but she could slip away and never have to drive back down the road in front of this house. But even if she got caught breaking and entering, nobody would blame her. She'd never spend one night in jail, not with the way Roger was doing her. Did he think she was stupid? Didn't he know how the town talked, how people were always primed for gossip? At first, Virginia hadn't realized that anything was amiss, and then her sisters had come to her with what they had heard at church, at the factory. Virginia chalked it all up to how much she and Roger fought. They didn't make a big secret out of their intense marriage. But when she really paid attention, Virginia recognized that Roger's absences had grown longer and more frequent. One night at supper, she watched his mind wander. He'd turn preoccupied, even when he was physically there. Virginia hated to admit she missed Roger's touch, but she did. She missed his hand on the small of her back when he kissed her in the morning. He'd grown to treat their infrequent contact as an obligation, and then finally stopped altogether. The past few months, he'd grown more distant from her and the kids. Her children didn't seem to notice, but once Virginia realized something was wrong, she saw it in his mannerisms and inflections, and even in his appetite. What had been a sort of foreplay in their high-tension marriage now held no interest for him. He had changed. It was as if, after all these years, their roles were reversing. Now her whole body ached for his weight against her. She regretted the time she'd pushed him away, imagined she was somewhere else when he reached for her. Now that his interest had shifted, it might be too late. He was getting his fantasies fulfilled elsewhere, from this whore nobody around here knew. So she was all painted up and teased and bleached. So she owned a beauty shop. Roger probably thought that was exotic. Maybe he was tired of a good woman who cooked his meals and took care of his home and his children. Maybe this woman reminded him of those whores in that movie Shampoo. Roger had insisted that they make a special trip up to Louisville to see it. Three women were practically clawing the hair off Warren Beatty's chest to have sex with him. If that was Roger's fantasy, he could just dream on. In real life, things were definitely the other way around. Even after they'd been married a number of years, it was a constant source of tension between them. This movie was apparently another of Roger's attempts to spice things up. He talked about that awful movie for days, pointing out things he found enticing, but it made Virginia feel dirty. Roger knew she couldn't handle strange sex, and he knew why. She turned her attention back to the woman's house, to the kitchen where she opened the refrigerator. There wasn't much. Beer, a bottle of wine, butter, pickles, old bread. There was a fast food bag stuffed in the garbage under the sink. This woman didn't cook. Virginia opened drawers and picked through mail on the counter. She didn't think Roger had enough sense to forward his mail. She opened and slammed cabinets. There were no sports of field among the hairstyles and beauty salon magazines on the coffee table. She went through the bathroom cabinets and saw medicine for yeast infections and birth control pills and an old-fashioned silver razor. She went through the dresser and found leopard print and red lace. She slammed those drawers. She even looked under the bed, but she didn't find the second thing that she had come for, a sign, any sign that her husband intended to stay. Virginia checked her watch. She'd been inside 20 minutes. She lowered the bedroom window and shut the closet door. In the kitchen, she locked the door handle and was ready to pull it closed behind her when she saw the photo. It was pinned to the side of the refrigerator with a magnet, nearly hidden by a newspaper clipping. She slid it out. The shot was grainy and dark, probably taken at dusk. They were seated at the picnic table in the backyard. She was on his lap, kissing him on the cheek. He was laughing. His hands nearly encircled her tiny waist. So this was it. They looked like a couple. They took photos. It wasn't just sex. And somebody had snapped the photo, so at least one other person knew. Maybe that person had been talking. Spreading lies was what Virginia had thought, but it wasn't a lie. She had known. Inside, she had known, or she wouldn't be here. She considered taking the photo as evidence, had actually put it in her pocket. But at the last moment, she balked. What good would it do? She would obsess over it, make herself sick with it. Plus, they might wonder where it went. Women know where things like a favorite photo live. She pinned the glossy paper back under the torn newsprint, checked that the handle locked, and pulled the kitchen door closed behind her. Her vision was liquid. The cool of shadows brushed her shoulders as she moved beneath the heavy canopy of oaks and tulip poplars toward her car. Although vines tripped her up, and logs blocked her way, she walked with purpose. She knew now. At least she had that much. She was no longer a fool. Now she knew.
Very nice. Very nice. Thanks very much. Yeah. Yeah. So obviously you have a gift for narrative. But I'm wondering, some time has elapsed between the fifth grade stories and the publication of Calling Home. So how did you work on your craft? What was your, did you go, you went to an MFA program?
No, I did not.
No?
I went to the University of Kentucky for undergrad and I majored in mass communications.
Yeah.
And when I got out of there, the reason that I majored in mass comm was I wanted to get a job and be able to support myself, you know.
What a concept.
Yeah. Right? And, I thought about theater and, thought about creative writing, and I just didn't think that I could make a living doing it. It just didn't seem feasible or, I don't know, practical. I came up in a practical family. So we have to, and I was the first person in my family to ever go to college. And so it was a huge deal. It's like, Jana's going to college. We're spending thousands of dollars to send her to college. She better major in something she can make a living at.
Become a lawyer or a doctor.
I felt a responsibility to my parents, that's a big deal if you're a UPS driver and my mom eventually filed taxes for an attorney. Uh-huh. That was a big deal. So then after I graduated from college, I met my husband and we were married and I moved to South Carolina and I got a master's degree in mass communications from the University of South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
I was working as a public relations person, writing media releases. Right. I wrote a thesis and I looked at my thesis and said, wow, that's a lot of work. That's actually a book. That proves I can write a book.
Gadzooks.
And up to that point, it had always seemed like such a monumental task that I had never actually attempted it, although I had these files of ideas and character names and things that I wanted to write about. I'd never actually sat down to do it before, but once I finished the thesis, I realized, oh, this is doable. I can do this. Just let me move forward on this and see what happens.
Yeah. Neat. And by that time, of course, you'd had a life rich in experience and,
This is true, too.
It's kind of a good understanding of human nature, shall we say.
I think, if you really look at debut authors and people who begin to make it as authors, truly few people make it before they're 40.
Right.
Because I truly believe that you just don't have the life experience to really empathize with other people and to write from a variety of points of view. And I'm a mother, and I don't believe that I could have written Virginia's point of view and how much she loved her child and how much she was willing to sacrifice for her daughter.
Right.
And she basically sacrifices the rest of her life for her daughter. I would never have thought that up if I had not had my own child.
If you'd not been a mother.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So life experiences, I mean, you can be as talented as anyone when it comes to prose, but if you don't have the life experiences and the understanding and the empathy of human nature, you can't truly be a writer, I don't think.
Right. As you know, poets often can become engaged with the very nature of language, and that becomes the substance in a way of what they do. But for a novelist, for someone who's writing fiction, that's and it's an undertaking of a different scale, certainly, and of a different order. I mean, there is the question of what one writes about, and
that's true. And I think I'm speaking more of literary fiction as well, as opposed to genre fiction, where the main character is not necessarily as affected by the outcome of the story. I mean, if I have a detective who shows up in 25 books,
right?
Even if she doesn't solve the crime, another book, another story could come along. Her life is not intimately affected by the outcome of the book.
Right.
Which is not true in literary fiction. In literary fiction, the main characters are vastly impacted by the outcome.
Yeah. I mean, major literary fiction, it tends to be transformative in some way, or to relate transformation. And sometimes to be transformative as well, depending on its impact on the reader. But and your book very much stands in that tradition, for sure.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I hoped it did.
Indeed. Well, let's hear some more of it. Explain the story arc, perhaps, and a little bit. And we should say, too, this is available. This is now in paperback. Recently,
it is available everywhere in the United States.
All good bookstores.
Hopefully all independent bookstores. Uh-huh. Of course, they select things to hand sell. Uh-huh. And I love the independent booksellers. And my independent bookseller in Columbia, South Carolina has been very, very good to me. The Happy Bookseller. I love them. Uh-huh. But it's available at every major bookstore online. If people go to my website, they can get links and things like that. So
okay. Yeah. And your website is?
It's myname.com.
Okay. So JennaMcMahon.com.
JennaMahan.com.
And there's a lot of information, some biography and other stuff as well on the website. It's a fascinating website. So.
Oh, well, thank you. A friend designed it for me. I was very pleased with what he did.
Came out well, indeed. And it seems like writers almost have to have websites these days.
It's true, but most of them are so boring. I hate to say that, but they're very copy heavy, you know, necessarily because we're writers. And I tried to keep mine a little cleaner and just give very specific bits of information. Mm-hmm. So, but there are links, different places, you know, magazine articles and things I've written, personal essays, and I want to add to it all the time. As a matter of fact, I was on a South Carolina educational television show with John Jakes and Dorothea Benton Frank last month.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm getting ready to put that up on my website. Hopefully it will go up today.
Oh, so. Good. It's a video?
It's a 30-minute program about the writing life, basically.
Oh, good. Good. Excellent. That's something to look forward to.
Yeah, so I hope to get it up soon.
Good.
Ben, get it up right now.
If you're listening.
Yeah. Okay, a little bit about the story.
Yeah.
The story is set in the late 1970s.
Okay.
And sort of the rock and roll era that I grew up in. I grew up going to concerts, all kinds of what we now consider classic rock.
Right.
And then
before it was classic.
Before it was classic. I'm not that old. Woo-hoo. But that was a time period when I was very confused by the social order of things as a child because I watched the interaction between my parents and basically between all the men and the women in our family, and it seemed like a great imbalance of responsibility to me.
No.
That's addressed somewhat in this book, but I didn't really hear about the women's rights movement. We didn't talk about politics a whole lot when I was growing up. And so when I went to college, it was a big shock to me to find out that women had so many more freedoms than they had in my hometown.
Really?
Yeah. And I knew that there was that something was wrong with this imbalance when I was a child, and I used to complain about it. And the men in the family would tease me all the time. Mm-hmm. But the story is basically about this girl who views this in what she thinks is an imbalance between the responsibilities of a man and the responsibilities of a woman. And she realizes that now she can go to college and perhaps have a career and choose to do something other than get married and have children and keep house. Mm-hmm. But it's, as they say in Kentucky, a hard row to hoe because there are a lot of things blocking her forward motion. Right. And it's basically the overall story is about the impact that the women's rights movement had on rural America. It took 10 years for it to begin to catch on in the rural areas. And so it's just about people, you know, waking up to new possibilities and this girl striving for that and the mother watching her and trying to help her do something that she was unable to do herself.
Right.
Thank you.
sure that's another first for WPVM. This is Van Halen doing Pretty Woman. You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 Asheville. WPVM is a broadcast service of Mount Mary Information Network. Without Maine, we wouldn't be here on the air. Maine's having a fundraiser right now, so head over to maine.nc.us and help them out with their Free the Airwaves fund drive.
Heard a little bit from the mother. The girl's name is Shannon, and Shannon gets a part-time job at a marina on a lake. And I had this job in between my freshman and sophomore years of college.
Uh-huh.
So I like this chapter because I feel like it gives a very good sense of place.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's one of the things people talk about when they read the book is like, it's even if they've never been to Kentucky. I had a woman from Illinois say, "Oh my God, that's what my childhood was like in Illinois." And then a woman from New Hampshire said, "That was what my childhood was like in New Hampshire." Mm-hmm. So apparently there is a universal feeling to the book that I didn't anticipate, but I'm very pleased.
Very happy
that
it is there.
Yes, I'm very pleased that people are reacting to it the way they are.
It's a curious thing that the more specific in place, emplaced as it were, that your fiction is, the more other people can identify it with it, even though they're from different places. But it's the sense of place, the sense of being in a specific location, that your book handles, I think, so well, that allows people, I think, to, you know, to leap into it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Well, this is about Shannon and her first real job and about her meeting her big roadblock.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Heavy morning fog haloed lights from the marina. Fish smell, faint in the parking lot, became stronger as Shannon neared the dock. Her footsteps were timid and hollow on the aluminum ramp. Lazy, sweet chirps called from the cricket box. Stiff, silvery bodies stuck to the walkway around the minnow. The dock rocked slightly and boats bobbed in countermotion in their slips. Sarah had worked with her the previous week, showing her how things were done, but today Shannon was on her own. Sarah said Mondays were always slow, that she could handle it by herself. The marina owner, Coleman, was already on a stool behind the counter counting money into the cash drawer. Sarah said it was his habit to come in and count money periodically. She also warned that he had roaming hands. "Let's see, can you make a decent pot of coffee?" Coleman said. "Sure," Shannon said. "How do you take it?" The old man snorted. "Any way I can get it, honey." He tapped a cigarette into an ashtray and the gold bracelet around his wrist clattered against the countertop. She filled a carafe, measured warm-smelling coffee, and flipped the machine on to brew. Last week was the first time Shannon had ever had coffee, and drinking the bitter brew made her feel jittery, but adult. "I want 2 eggs, over-easy toast, 2 sausage," Coleman said. Shannon twisted the knobs on the grill. There were a few audible clicks and the poof of combustion. Flames warmed the metal surface. "When do people start showing up on weekdays?" she asked. "Round 7, that's fishing folks. Boat people start coming in round 8. "Well, what about the houseboat girls?" "Oh, they don't usually show up till 10 or so. They ain't dependable." "They know what to do. Clean the boats, I mean." "Yeah, you got to keep track of their time while they're here. Make sure they don't clock in for one another and stuff like that. They'll steal me blind if you don't watch them. They seem to like them pink snowballs and little Debbies a lot." "Okay. And you handle the rentals. Most folks call ahead, take the credit card number over the phone, write it all down, and I'll call back to confirm." Shannon tossed 2 frozen patties on the grill. They sizzled and popped. She cracked eggs. Smoke twisted above Coleman's head. Make sure customers pay. Sometimes they get to talking and walk right on out without paying. Prices for worms, crickets, and minnows is up on that post behind the register. Drinks is $75, candy's $50. Other stuff like life preservers, bobbers, suntan lotion should all be marked. If it ain't, you just got to guess. Shannon knew all of this from Sarah's instructions, but she just nodded as if the information were new, and she glanced around the jumbled store. Metal racks held snack cakes and chips, behind them two rows of sundries, soap, cornflakes, aspirin, cans of beef stew, and Vienna sausages. Upright coolers against the back held sodas, milk, and bologna. Ice is big business, he went on, and you know it's a dry county, right? Right. Makes city folks mad when they find out we don't sell no alcohol, but you can send them out to Big John's on the county line if they got to have something, because, you know where that is, right? Yeah, I know. Yeah, I bet. Coleman rubbed his stubbly red beard, and Shannon wondered how old he was. Most people older than 40 seemed the same age to her. He motioned to the dusty wooden skis hanging above the screen door. Had them skis for 3 summers now. You sell them, and I give you $20. A happy skier waved from a logo that said Cypress on the top and Gardens on the bottom. Shannon had never skied. She had been out in running trot lines with her daddy a couple of times. The screen door groaned open, and two men in swimming trunks and t-shirts shuffled across the wooden floor and pulled out stools. Their faces were drawn and tired, but their bodies were slender and tan. Hey, one of them said. New girl, I'm Rob. His eyes were set deep, giving him a brooding look. Hey, Rob, Shannon smiled. Can I get you something? Tomato juice. And how about you? She said to the other one. Same. She rooted around in the cooler and came up with a large can. Throw a couple ice cubes in there for me, darling. This one's eyes were like secondary roads on a map. I'm Kyle, he said. Shoot some hot sauce in mine. He pulled a bottle from a back pocket of his shorts and added clear liquid into each glass. Turn up on Q104, would you? We need some music. Shannon cooked breakfast for most of the houseboat people and a couple who came by with a big mess of bass that they traded to Coleman for gas and 2 ham and egg sandwiches. Their boat etched a perfect V in the cove as it pulled away from the buoys toward flat, open lake. Shannon liked the marina. It was crawling with activity. Already she could tell when a boat was coming in by how the water line moved against the bank outside the restaurant's windows. Men's footfalls shook the dock. Children were like scurrying animals. Only a woman could glide along undetected by her sense of vibration. When speedboaters launched, the whole marina shook. They revved motors and churned water. A psychedelic slick of oil spread around the metallic boats. The gearheads took off before clearing the buoys and made large wakes that banged boats against the dock. When their engines whined into the distance, the cove grew quiet again. Shannon was excited. At lunchtime, 6 people hung around the counter talking and smoking, and Sarah had told her the routine. First thing in the morning came the boozers, who couldn't sleep despite hangovers, and then the people fishing since before daylight. Around lunchtime, pleasure boaters and skiers showed up with their pink-cheeked, coconut-smelling children. And on Saturdays, the rental people came in from Louisville and Lexington, pale and tense, always on edge and poised to be dissatisfied. They brought coolers heavy with beer and food, and they left a few days later burned and relaxed, headed back to their desks and plants and companies, their coolers and psyches lighter. The renters and regular Lakers didn't mix well, so Coleman kept them far apart on different wings of the marina. After Shannon cleaned up from lunch, she waited for food delivery and flipped through catalogs. Coleman had asked her to order a gas hose for his runabout. She looked through shots of smiling families in their new life preservers and handsome men on skis with rooster tails of water flying out behind them. Sarah usually ordered everything for Coleman in the store, but Shannon would work on Mondays, delivery days, so she would check deliveries against orders. All day long they came, the cheerful snack guys and soda guys, the hustling UPS man, teenagers who sold night crawlers. Shannon watched a red delivery truck come down the sloping road to the marina parking lot. Black and white checkered flags were the background for a logo that read Lexington Motor Supply in giant letters on the side panels. The guy who got out had the blackest hair and the darkest tan Shannon had ever seen. He was tall and lean, and he moved like a cat, slinking over the walkway onto the dock. He stopped to check out a catch in somebody's well, and he clapped one guy on the back, and laughter tumbled from them. And when he came inside, he slid onto a stool and smiled. and his teeth were as white as chiclets. "Hey there, darling," he said. "What's your name?" "Shannon." "I'm Jake," he said, and leaned over the counter to shake her hand. "Nice to meet you. I'm your handy-dandy motor oil salesman here to fill all your lubrication needs." "I've been expecting you." "You have?" "Yeah. Sarah told me you might be coming today." "Oh, and what else did she tell you about me?" "That I shouldn't believe a word out of your mouth."
Which proves to be good advice.
That Shannon doesn't take.
Yeah, right. Of course. Of course. Oh. Well, this much of the story of Shannon, of course, occurs during the era of your own youth. Did you have to go back and do a lot of research? You mentioned going to the Rupp Arena.
There's a large
rock and roll concert that figures in the story.
That's true. And there's a big Van Halen concert.
Yeah.
And she goes to this concert with Jake. And when I was trying to decide where to set the concert and, you know, what time period, I went to Rupp Arena and said, "I'm a writer and I want to set a book in Rupp Arena." And one of the guys said to this other guy, "Hey, don't we have a scrapbook somewhere?" And the other guy said, "Yeah, I thought we kept a scrapbook for every year when the arena first opened. Where do you think that is?" And they talked about it. And one guy said, "I think it's down in the storage closet." So he said, "Follow me." So we go down in the basement of Rupp Arena. And this is one of the great parts about being a writer is people are willing to help you. You meet people you would never ordinarily meet, and you get to do things you would never ordinarily get to do.
Right.
And so we found all of the scrapbooks. And this,
that must have been a hoot.
It was wonderful because I started college in 1981, and that's about the time Rupp Arena opened. And I could sit there and point to every one of the concerts I went to. They had the ticket stubs. They had all of the reviews, all of the upcoming events that were in the entertainment part of the paper. And I was like, oh, I went to that one. I saw Cheap Trick, and I saw the Rolling Stones, and I saw The Who. And I went through, and I realized that I needed this concert to take place in October for everything to work out time-wise in my story. So I just went to that year in October, and I looked in a Van Halen concert, I believe it was on October 22nd. Mm. And I said, that's it. I'm going to have her go to that Van Halen concert right there. So the concert did take place in Rupp Arena that is in the book. You know, you take creative license as an author about a lot of things, but when you can connect up something that's really real and have people say, "I was at that concert too," people like that, and that makes it fun. It makes it entertaining.
Point of contact, right? Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that day a lot.
Yeah, I bet you did.
I've done all kinds of things. I've actually been out with in Richland County down in Columbia where I live. I've been out with a Richland County sheriff and been the car when he chased a criminal out. You jump out of the car and chase a criminal who jumps out his window and runs out through a field. And I've been to a morgue. And I've just done a lot of crazy things you wouldn't ordinarily get to do.
So is the new novel going to be set in South Carolina?
The new novel is set in South Carolina along the Barrier Islands, Pauly's Island.
Oh, yeah.
And I made up an island called Lafayette Isle.
Lafayette Isle. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because some things happened there that are sort of unsavory, so I didn't want to
use a real place.
Yeah, use a real place, exactly. Yeah. And then there is a real island called Sandy Island that is inland. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there are no roads to Sandy Island.
And there's
an African-American community that has existed there that was formed after the Civil War. And basically some black families squatted on the land, and they lived there without water or electricity for many years. And in the 50s, the state ran electricity to them, and they just left them there. And they take boats in and out, and the children go to public school. And so it's the only public school boat in the state of South Carolina. And when I found out about this island, I thought, how interesting. I'd love to write about that. And so I called the Georgetown newspaper and said, oh, can I have an assignment to go report on the school boat? Mm-hmm. And they hired me. That way I could be certified or qualified, if you will, to ride the school boat with the children, which was just a wonderful day. Hmm. And so you get the poor children have to get on the bus, and then they go to the boat dock, and then they get on the boat and they ride over to the island, which is about 2 miles on the river, on the Waccamaw River, and then they get off, and then they get, some of them get on a Jeep, and then they go another couple of miles into the interior of the island. And I just found that so, I rode all the way into the interior island, and I found that so interesting that these children travel, you know, they just put such great effort into getting to school every single day. And this one child who lived the farthest inland wanted to be a teacher when she grew up, and so I based a character on her because she was just such a lovely individual.
Yeah. Sandy Island. So it's on the Waccamaw.
Yes. Well, it's right behind Brook Green Garden.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I know where Brook Green is. I've been there
and
many
Brook
a time.
And Brook Green's in the book, too. In the new book,
good,
too.
Good.
So.
Yeah. Something to look forward to. Are there any characters from Calling Home who show up in the new novel as well?
No.
No. No.
Each of my books are freestanding. You know, they're individual books. So.
Yeah. Well, good, good. Something to look forward to. And that's going to be out next April?
It will be out in April.
April 2009.
And anyone who follows South Carolina politics will find part of the book amusing.
Mm-hmm.
Considering what happened to our state treasurer last year. So.
What did happen to the state treasurer?
Thomas Ravenel.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that one.
He was indicted on cocaine charges.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He said he had a social issue.
A social issue.
And it was really funny because, you know, I wrote an 11,000 word outline and I sent the outline to my agent to read first. And she's in her early 30s, and I thought it was kind of funny. She got back with me and said, oh, I love this, and I love this, and it's going to be so descriptive, and it'll be a great setting. But I just don't think that it's credible that people in their 40s would be doing cocaine at a party.
She didn't get out much, did she?
I was like, who do you think has the money and time to do that, you know? And then the next week, our state treasurer was indicted. And so I emailed her the front page of the state newspaper, and all she did was write back, and she just did like the little Homer Simpson thing. She just went, dope. Yeah, you know, the whole email. She's like, never mind. Just go right ahead and write it. I think you know what you're doing. Okay, so.
Cool.
So.
Right. Yeah. Are there any concerts in the new book? Rock and roll? Does rock and roll play a role?
Well, not so much. There's a little bit of hip hop in the new book, and then beach music.
And beach music, of course.
So the kids, they go to Cancun and kind of have their little Cancun rendezvous, and they go to some discos down there. And, you know, there's some different hip hop songs playing down there. And then, of course, you cannot be at the beach without beach music.
No, it's everywhere. Yeah, so, in South Carolina. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Right. If you ever go to Myrtle Beach, you'll hear beach music. Ocean Drive, OD is where it's supposedly originated.
The OD instead of the OD. All right, I love it. All right.
Oh.
I think that's catchy. That'll catch on.
Yeah. Well, Janet, thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, I had
really
a great
appreciate
time.
It. Good.
Thank
good.
You so much.
A pleasure. Another first for WPVM. We're closing with Free Bird. You've been listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me today, Columbia novelist Jana McMahon. For more information and links, you can check naturespoetry.blogspot.com. See you next week.